You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Nate Miller. Nate is an amazing actor. He's one of the busy artistic directors of the theater company Lesser America, and he's a hilarious and lovely artist to be in the room with. Nate was in the class right after me at Juilliard, and he's one of my husband's closest friends. His joy and generous spirit permeate everything he's involved in, and I'm so glad he agreed to share his stories with me for the podcast. I hope you enjoy the 37th episode of The Compass.
My pleasure. I've been wanting to do it for a long time.
So, Nate, what is the dark side for you? And how do you try to avoid going there as an artist?
Well, I think the dark side takes many different forms. I'm a person who likes to be busy. For example, right now, I'm not working on a job, and my theater company just finished producing a play. And so I've had like a whole week to myself where I like have not yet gone back fully to my day job. And I just like chill at my house. So like everything's really clean now. And like everything's really organized. And my inbox and my email is like now empty, which is fantastic. It makes me feel really good. But like all that's done now. So now I really don't know what to do with myself. And that is truly like when the dark thoughts creep in of like, what if I never work again? Like what if I never have enough money to like be a person in the world? What if I'm 65 and I still like need to, you know, be a barista? Like that's a terrifying prospect. That's the dark place for me, is like where my mind goes in those times. I'm also an only child, and I think as a result of that, like I have a great imagination, and I've spent a lot of time like by myself, like inventing characters and hanging out by myself and entertaining myself. But then I moved to this city called New York, where there's just people everywhere. And like for me, it's like a kid in a candy store. Like I love community. I love hanging out with people. Like I love, you know, just I'm a very, very social person. So that is probably getting to your question of like, how do you combat the dark side? Like I like to be with people, and I like to hang out. But the second part of that dark side is this city is really expensive, and everything in this city that's social. I mean, there are, of course, options that don't cost money, but like a lot of things are built around like food and drinks and events that all cost money. So when you're not working, and like the way I want to combat things is like, I just want to meet up with people and hang out and, you know, like hang out with friends that I haven't seen in a long time. And then that costs money. And I'm like, but I'm not working. Oh no, I'm going to be so poor, or I am already and I'm going to be poorer.
Yeah.
That's my dark side. Yeah, that's interesting. One of my New Year's resolutions was, I'm a co-founder of this theater company called Lesser America. Mm-hmm. And, I've always felt like very in control of my social interactions, that like, it's sure, you're meeting up with people and you're talking about the business, and sometimes you're talking about the company, and sometimes you're talking about your own individual, journey that you're on. But I always felt like it's with a compatriot or like another member of my community. So I don't consider it like work or difficult.
Just your peers.
Just my peers. Yeah. But then there's been several times now where throughout the past like 2 or 3 years where people have been like, I'd really love to have coffee with you and talk about your theater company, because I want to make a theater company too. And I'm like, that's awesome. I would love to, you know, like I don't know any more than anybody else. Like I didn't like figure this all out and like now our theater company is perfect. Like
right.
it's not that at all. We continue to be very lucky and we have a lot of help. But so I end up like going to these coffee meetings with people that I don't know that well, and they're basically just like, okay, so like theater company, I want to make one, so just like tell me how to do it. And I'm like, I don't oh man, I don't have an answer to that. So my New Year's resolution, getting back to that, was that like I'm not going to go to any meetings that are going to cost me time and money and energy unless it's with somebody who like actually has some concrete questions. So I try to like do those things over email first and then go somewhere, because I was just spending like a lot of Saturdays going and eating expensive lunches with people who I, you know, like, kind of know. And like, I don't have any good information for them and they don't have any real questions for me. So that aspect of it, I try to keep control of my own social behavior in that, like, I want it to be worth it for me in a soul way. Like, I want it to make me happier and not just be... Actors can get real down on themselves. That dark place is like a real thing for every single person. And when, you know, Richard Feldman, our acting teacher back at school, used to say energy begets energy. And I mean, like, I have watched it happen where it just takes one person to be like, oh, can I just complain about something for a second? And all of a sudden it's like the whole room is tears because everyone's just having the worst day. So I try to make sure that the social aspect of my thing doesn't just turn into a constant gripe session.
Yeah.
And like, we can keep focused on positive things in the future moving forward. You know, what kind of steps can we take? Awesome. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about how you guys started the company?
Yeah, totally.
Or why?
Totally. So I got out of Juilliard in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first acting job that I got out of school was that summer. There was this play called Keep Your Baggage With You at All Times.
I forgot that was right after you graduated.
Yeah, it was. It was in like August after we graduated. We did this play. I met Laura Ramadeh and Dan Ablis. They were both acting in the play as well. And they and the writer of the play were talking about starting a theater company, theater collective, and they were all NYU kids. And they asked me if I wanted to be involved, and I basically said, like, that's adorable. I went to Juilliard. I'm about to be famous. So I've got about 10 more minutes of doing this downtown theater with you kids. And then I'm going to be on a series. That's not true. That's not true at all. But the truth of it was I did feel like I had just gotten out of school. I had just spent 4 years focusing and working really, really hard on trying to create a career for myself in this business that's difficult. And I know that theater companies are difficult. I've watched a lot of people build them, some very successfully, some not so much. And I was just like, man, I don't think I have the time or the money or the wherewithal to like jump into this thing whole hog and try to like make, a company, like a thing with many moving parts that needs attention at all times. But then that Theater for the New City, heard these whisperings that we were going to start a collective of some kind, and they very generously said, would you guys like to be one of our companies in residence? And we were like, well, what does that mean? And they were like, we will give you space, and we will give you access to our shop and our props and our costumes, and you can produce here for free, and we will just take like a big cut of your box office.
Oh my gosh.
And we were like, joke's on you. We're not going to make any money at box office. Take all the money if you want. There's none there. But that is true. That is the way that it began. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like space costs everything. And so, yeah, we started, I think our first show was like, I think we spent like $5,000, like all in. Paying the actors and the designers and the director and everything, you know, like we made sets out of cardboard and quite literally trash. Like we found stuff off the street. We stole stuff off the street, out of dumpsters, like anything we could find. And that was how it began. And every day I think about my dark side and what that is and how it manifests itself and how lucky I am that my compatriots with that company invited me into this thing that keeps me always busy, always having something else to focus on, even when like the audition didn't go well, or like even if I'm doing a show not in New York, if I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, or I'm in La Jolla or something, like that show makes me upset or I feel bad and I feel like, oh, I wish I was in New York. I wish I was with my people. There's several emails from all of them being like, have you done this yet? We have to figure out the PR for the next show. We got to find the, have you read the script? The script is really great. You got to check it out. Like, it keeps me grounded and feeling like even when your individual career as an actor, you feel stalled or like you're moving backwards, that is always a thing that like, there's always work to do to move forward. I feel like I'm making strides as an artist. And it could very easily not be that way if I had really been like, I don't want to take the time to like worry about something that's going to cost me, you know, time and effort from my own career. Man, if I focused on my own career more than I do, like I think it would kill me.
Yeah.
This company has served as a beneficial tool for keeping focused, recharging my artistic batteries when I get depleted on the other side of things. Mm-hmm. It's really fantastic. And I also, it serves the other side of that too, which is the social. We've been really lucky, but we've also put a lot of hard work into building a community of artists and collaborators who have been a part of Lesser America in the past or continue to be or will be in the future, but are just like usual suspects at our shows and at our parties. I feel like I'm very plugged into this city and the art that is happening here, not just theater, but I mean, dance and music and visual art. I mean, I've gotten to meet so many wonderful people who are now a part of this big family. So it never makes it feel like going to work. It makes it feel like going to make work with your friends, having a ball.
Yeah, well, especially if you're working with the people that you enjoy creating with and being around.
And those fools at Lesser America are the best.
They're super fun.
They're the sweetest. Yeah.
So now it's what, how many shows later?
We just finished our ninth, Half Moon Bay. And we're going to do our 10th in January. So now we're no longer at Theater for the New City. We've moved west. We're still down in the village. We're in the West Village now at the Cherry Lane Theater, and we're their inaugural resident company. We're their first company to be in residence there. So we just did our first show with them, and we're going to do another one in January.
It's kind of wonderful, because I was thinking about this earlier before you came over, that you're at Theater for New City. You did a show at Rattlestick.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're at Cherry Lane. History of off Broadway theater.
Yeah.
In New York. Like those are the theaters that I saw things at right when I moved to the city. There's such a rich history there.
Totally, me too. I would have never dreamed, and I think that's the way it works, or the way that it's supposed to work, but I don't think you get to like walk in and be like, someday I'm gonna produce a show at Rattlestick because I love this place and I saw, like, I think if that was your intention, it wouldn't go that way. Much like acting. Like, I don't think you get to be like, I like that show, The West Wing. I'm going to be on it. You know, like, I wish it did. I think sometimes, you know, those beautiful dreams. It's shit. Yeah. The West Wing would be a cast of 450,000 New York actors. But we just kept making work that inspires us in the exact same way that I think the work we've seen at those places, these institutions now, has inspired us. And those two things come together, and all of a sudden the people at Rattlestick or the people at Cherry Lane start to take notice, and they're like, so they're kind of doing like what we're kind of doing. Why don't we invite them in, and then we can all do it together?
Yeah.
And so in that way, it's been, I guess all I'm trying to say is that like, we're not brilliant and tactical. We're just driven and very, very lucky. And we just make the stuff that we want to see.
Have you found a love for the producing side now that you've done some of these shows? Or like, you're not acting in them also, you're solely producing. Do you find some joy out of that? Or is it just the fact that you're getting to see the company create something? I'm not articulating this.
No, but I think I understand what you're after. I have a very palpable love-hate relationship with producing.
It's just not easy, especially when you're dealing with money and fundraising.
Totally. It's not. It's the things I love about it are, it gives me a chance to, like I said before, like to recharge your artistic batteries. It gives me a chance to be on the other side of the table, and not just be focused on the acting of something and the minuscule, the moments of a piece, the beats of a scene, I get to be worried about a much bigger picture. And that is nice. That actually is like a little vacation from the minutia of something going into a big picture land. It gives me a lot of respect for all of the people who have to work really hard at what they're doing in order for me to like worry about the minutia of a scene when I'm acting in a play. So I love that. I do love the fact that we're able to be a place where new work gets made and where people get an opportunity to act, to design lights, to make things. I told you how the company started, but I will also tell you one of my like driving factors of asking myself, once we found out that we had space, I was like, okay, it now seems possible, since Theater for the New City has given us a residency, it seems possible, like it won't break us financially. Let's do this. Now why, though? Why am I going to make a theater company? Is it literally just to like make my own opportunities so that I can be in plays and then people can see me and then hopefully I can like get famous and go?
Right.
And that really wasn't what I was after. But I remember having a conversation with our friend Marco Ramirez, who is a fantastic playwright, also an amazing, he's like a showrunner and a producer and a writer for TV and also in movies. But I remember talking to him, I guess it was my fourth year at school, about, your plays are fantastic. Like, when is it going to be, when are you going to hook it up in New York? And he was like, well, you can't really do anything in New York until you get something that's like doing pretty well regionally. And I was like, oh, okay, well, when are you gonna do some regional stuff? He's like, you can't really get anything going on regionally until you have something that's kind of a hit in New York. And I was like, well, there are theaters in New York that like devote themselves to new playwrights, to young playwrights, right? And, like, what about Theater Row? What about Playwrights Horizons? What about Signature? And let me just preface this with all the respect in the world to Signature and Playwrights and, and Theater Row. I think those places are fantastic. It's just it's a delicate balance of like, how do you get new work seen?
Right. You get into that emerging writer land.
Right, totally. And like, those are theaters that need to pay their bills and need to make sure their subscribers keep coming back. So like, for example, he was like, Playwrights Horizons, like they're going to do like the new David Mamet play and they're going to do the new Chris Durang play. But like, there's people there that want to see the writers they remember being young with their new stuff. Like, they want to check that out. It's hard to get your foot in the door there. And I was like, okay, well then let that be for that generation of theater goers. And like, cause like, I'll produce your play. I don't have a lot of money, but like, I'll produce it. And I think we'll do a really good job with it. It won't be a $1 million set. It won't have all the glitz and spectacle of like a show that has a lot of money behind it, but it'll certainly have passion and it'll have young actors and young designers all really want to like make their mark on it, really show what they can do with a piece. So that was my driving force, was I guess A, for the writers, but B, I mean, it's true for directors, actors, designers. That brings me great joy to know that not only are we like, it's not like benevolent, like we're giving everybody, it's not that as much as it is like we're getting to make our own thing together and we're all sort of at this similar level of beginning our careers, starting to get noticed, starting to get some following. So I feel like, yeah, hopefully someday we will be a part of that history of Rattlestick and Cherry Lane, of like people come up to you and be like, oh, you were a member of Labyrinth. You're a member of Steppenwolf. How did you guys start that? I hope that we're still telling that story 20, 30 years from now. Like, wow, you guys started Lust for America? Like, what was it like in the beginning?
Yeah.
I'll be like, we've had to chase heroin addicts out of Theater for the New City. Like, yeah.
That was where it was.
That was, yeah.
You talked about that it was interesting to be on the other side of the table. Like, when you're in audition mode as an actor, do you find that changes the way you go into a room now, having had more experience on the other side, or you have the agency and the power?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if it gives me any more or less agency or power, but it gives me a chance to let go of, I mean, acting is a personal thing. You're using your own emotions, your own point of view. You're giving yourself fully, and you're opening your little protective heart box up completely. You know, you're vulnerable. You're there, quite literally, like pushing yourself towards embarrassment purposefully. So when a casting director or somebody just says like, "Great, thanks, next," you know, you're like, "Oh, my tiny little heart." Being on the other side of the table has given me insight into the fact of like, it's almost never about you.
Yeah.
But as an actor, I know it feels, it really feels
it
like,
really,
you know, it feels like it's personal. Mm-hmm. Like they don't like you. I went to, this is a good example. Mm-hmm. I went to an audition for a TV show, and it was like three lines, and the lines were, they were like, "Yes, I don't know. Yeah, move him." Like, those were the three lines that I had to go into an office and say. And so I traveled from Brooklyn into Manhattan. It took me like 45 minutes to get there. I sat in the waiting room. They were behind. Sat there for like a half hour. Walked in. I swear I was in that room for under a minute, because it was like, you know, "Hey, Nate. Okay, we're just going to do it right away. Great. Hey, yep. I don't know. Yep, you should move him. Okay, cool. Have a good day." And I walked out, and then the casting director guy comes out, and he was like, "Lose the beard, right?" I have a big beard, for the people at home who can't see that. I have a big beard. And he looked at me, and he was like, "Lose the beard, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, if you need me to." And he gave me this look that was like, "Oh, sure, yeah, for the TV show if you book it. But I think what I'm trying to tell you is you should get rid of the beard."
Really?
Like, that's what I walked away with, the feeling being. And then I was like, okay, now I'm going to get back on the train and spend 45 minutes going back to my house in Brooklyn. So I think what just happened is I spent about an hour, close to 2 hours, to get less than a minute of time to quote unquote act, and then have somebody tell me that they don't like the way I look and that I should change something about myself.
No.
And I texted my girlfriend that. I'm like, "What is this business we're in?" And she was very sweet, and she took care of me and made me feel better. But like, but I look back on that now, I can laugh about it, because like, I didn't book that part. Surprise. I didn't book that part because of any number of reasons. It probably had nothing to do with my beard. It probably had nothing to do with me as an actor. It was probably like they cast somebody taller because the actor who they have to be talking to is a really tall guy.
Right.
It's nothing I can control, and it's nothing that I need to feel bad about myself for. And I've booked a lot of things because of this beard, so...
That's true.
Screw you, bro.
Two plays in a row, right?
I know. It's so weird. I think now when people in school ask me, like, how do you get an agent? How do you, I'm just going to look at the boys and say, "Grow a beard. Grow a beard. That's all you need."
Hair acting.
That's all you need.
So you've been doing a lot of plays in school.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work out the financial part of your life, like when you're between shows or
mm-hmm.
when the shows aren't paying you enough or whatever it is?
Well... It's a constant negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of things. I have a day job. I have a jobby job.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really lucky. I've worked for this tour bus thing called The Ride in New York City for like 5 years. And I've done all kinds of things there. I've been a host, like the actual tour guide on the bus. I've done that mostly the whole time, but they have performers on the street, so I've like sang on the street. I've been a freestyle rapper. Now I've kind of transitioned out of all the performance elements, and I'm one of the creative directors, so I help get new hosts in, train them, give them notes on the, yeah. I do both. Like I still host a little bit, but I also am just by virtue, I think, of being there the longest. I've seen The Ride in all of its different iterations. So now I, you know, help direct a little bit with a couple of the other creative directors. So that's a great job for many reasons. One is it's pretty flexible. I can schedule myself, you know, just for nights and weekends, and we trade shifts with each other. So You know, if I know I'm not going to have any auditions for the first part of the week, then I can work during the days. Or if I do end up getting an audition that I need to get out of, I can call a couple people at the ride. Usually somebody can switch the shift with me. That's been great. It's a job where I get to perform, which is fantastic. It's like a job where I get to be quick on my feet. I get to improv. I get to act. I get to be funny. And that goes a long way towards making your day job bearable. If you're a person like me who is social and likes to be fun and funny and perform a lot. I think if I was just waiting tables or being a bartender, and I've done it, lots of people do it, but I think that for me right now, that's a thing that would really make me, it would take me deeper into the dark place. Even though it was, I'd be getting money for it, it would like not equal out. It would make me sad and angry. So that's one thing. Another thing is I have the most supportive, unbelievable parents in the world who constantly are not only financially supportive, and they are, make no mistake, they have helped me with everything from health insurance to help with rent to help with credit card debt to help with student loans. You know, there seems to be several times in my life where like all of a sudden every bill in the world is due on the same day, and it's like, oh. And I've had this conversation with my parents many times where I'm like, I'm a 31-year-old man. I went to grad school. I went to this good school, I think, like one of the best ones. And I feel like I'm doing a good job. Like I act all over the country and I act in New York, and I'm, yeah, like I don't think I'm unsuccessful. Like I feel like I'm doing it all right, and I can't support my life, which is very meager in New York City. Like I've wanted an iPad for 6 years, and I every job I've done, I've been like, on this one, I think I'll save enough money and I will buy an iPad. But like, it just, it goes away. It goes to, oh, I have the money now. Like I should pay for a year of health insurance since I have the weeks to do that. Like just buy that now, do that now. That's really important. That's more important than an iPad, Nate. So yeah.
Yeah, but having that little bit of wiggle room where you, if you want to buy something, you can buy it.
Totally. Totally. So anyway, that being said, I just want to say out loud to anybody who thinks that being an actor in New York City, even one who works pretty consistently, I mean, we do not make a lot of money.
No.
I've heard it so many times from so many actors older than me, like, I hope you're not getting into this for the money thing. I would never tell anybody, be like, if you can do anything else, get out now. You should do. I don't believe in that. I believe if this is what you want to do, this is what you should do. And I'll tell you what, I get paid 100 other ways than money. I get paid in the heart. I get paid with happiness. I get paid with community and friends and just like love, you know? Wow, that's going to be the soundbite. That's the grooviest, hippiest thing I've ever said. I just get paid with love. But you should also get paid a living wage. And I've been very lucky to work at some wonderful theaters in New York, some institutions, I think we can call them.
Yeah.
And I have been poorer at the end of those jobs than I was when I started. And that is unbelievable. And a couple of those jobs, after taxes and you pay your agent, like I don't have a manager or anything. Like my money's going to the one place that I think you, most actors need, you like have to have an agent these days mostly. After that, there's been a couple of those jobs where like, I'm getting paid less than unemployment. It would actually behoove me to be lazy on my couch. I'm not saying that anybody who's unemployed is lazy on their couch. Let me just say that. But like, it would behoove me to be sitting on my couch, not doing anything, because if I could claim unemployment, I would actually be making more. It makes fiscal sense for me to not work in this huge theater. That's like, that's just,
well, and I know you might be more informed about this than I am. I know Actors Equity is going through some things right now with off-Broadway contracts to try to improve,
mm-hmm,
kind of like the Actors Equity minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah. Right now we are negotiating the off-Broadway contract, and we're just, that's our main bullet point.
It's like, it's not, mm-hmm, enough for a week, full week's work.
To- totally. And I mean, I'm talking about me as I'm like a single man with no dependents. I have a girlfriend, but I certainly don't. Yeah, I don't support her.
Yeah.
She supports me more often than not, if we're being honest. But like, it's just me, you know. And I live in a house with roommates, and like we all share the burden of rent and groceries and all that stuff. But like, I just think about there's people with children, and like they how do you do that? How do you put a kid through school?
Well, and then, like, you've done a lot of regional work, and generally those theaters pay a lot more, right? I did want to ask you about your family, because I know your parents are so supportive. Hi, Mom and Dad, wherever you are, we love you.
They're the sweetest.
They're the best. So two questions.
Sure.
One, I wanted to ask about your family growing up, and, like, when you decided to be a performer, and how they kind of dealt with that. What's it been like to travel so much and to live in New York and to be so far from your family?
Sure.
For this career?
Well, I think if you ask me, I say that I really decided I wanted to be an actor. I always liked acting, and I was in plays in elementary school and middle school and on and on and on. But I think I didn't really decide that I wanted to be an actor as a career until, you know, in high school, like maybe sophomore, junior year, I started to think about this being a thing I really wanted to pursue as my life. But if you ask my parents, they're like, oh, we knew when he was 2 years old and he was running around. There is a true story of my parents would came to pick me up at some birthday party, and they like walked into the room full of kids and I wasn't there. And they were like, where is Nathan? So they walked into the kitchen and I was there with all the adults, and they were like, oh, he's been just with us, like entertaining us, doing accents and different voices and stuff instead of, cause the other kids didn't care. But like the adults, they were a savvy crowd, you know, you could really land a joke. So I think according to them, they knew to deal with it from day one, that they had a performer on their hands. Once again, I'm an only child, so that's given my parents don't have to split time between their offspring. So though I've been, you know, working kind of in several different parts of the country, they almost always come and see opening night or closing night or come at some point during the run because they can just sort of pick up together. My dad's retired. He was a firefighter for 30 years, but he's done now. So he's kind of free and easy, and he loves to drive. So they'll jump in the van. My mom's a professor at Concordia University in Wisconsin. So she has like a weekend free, or if she can like take a couple of days off, they'll just fly out to me, or they'll drive to me or whatever. So I would say that I miss them terribly, except that I see them all the time. It's funny to think about them as being supportive. They certainly are, but I feel like they're so much more than being supportive. Like, they really are, like, they're a member of the crew. They're a member of the family. When I say family, I mean, like, the community family of artists. I mean,
it's true. They definitely adopted Frankie and I.
That's true. They know all the Juilliard kids. They know all the Lesser Americans. They make themselves very at home at my apartment whenever they come through. Like, you know, they come and hang, and they like to party. So they're a big part of it. Yeah, they're like not so much supportive as much as they are just equal members in this whole thing. I mean, it really is a team effort. We're a small family business, as my mother likes to say, which I appreciate.
Do you think that you're in New York for the long haul? I know you went out to LA for one pilot season.
I did. That was difficult. This is the thing about, yeah, exactly. This is the thing about being, in the position that we are in the profession we're in. I can make all the plans I want. Like, I do love New York. LA, I had a bad experience with. The city's delightful, but I didn't, you know, it would seem to me like starting over in a new city where I don't have this community that I find myself to be really embedded in. And I feel like I've made a lot of steps in this city And I love it here. I genuinely love it here. So there's a big part of me that's like, nope, you know, sooner or later I'm going to get like a really permanent place in Brooklyn. I'm going to buy a dog. I'm going to rescue a dog. And we're going to live our dreams together in New York City. And I'll just continue to make it work. And like, hopefully I can book some TV. But like, I think the moment that I were to have enough money and buy a place and get that dog, there would be like, hey, there's this thing in Los Angeles. Come out here. You know, it could change at any moment.
Yeah, just a mess with you.
Totally. You know? Or there, yeah, I mean, but if I had my druthers, I would love to stay in this city. It's the home of independent theater. It's the home of brave new art that is not for everybody, but is welcomed. Everybody is welcomed to. It's a place of strong opinions. It's a place of social change. It's a place of conversation. And I don't ever want to be anywhere where those things are not a part of the conversation. And the community here is just so diverse, and I, sure, like different cultures and backgrounds, whatever, but like just so many different opinions, such diversity of opinion and point of view. And that just makes the conversation on any given night so rich and beautiful. I mean, it's not that way everywhere in this country, I can tell you. And that's a thing that I don't ever want to be without.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd like to stay in New York for a good long time. Till the water rises. But that's another story.
do you have any other artistic outlets that you hobbies, things you... Are you a writer?
Kind of. I mean, I was actually having this conversation with Damon Dono, my other roommate, last night.
Mm-hmm.
Both of our girlfriends are brilliant actresses, but they are also writers of sketches and short film and television. And he asked me if I write, and I was like, you know, I've never written a full story front to back, except like for school or something, you know, for a playwriting class. But I do like to write jokes. I like write like just like little like, this is a funny sketch idea. This is a funny sketch idea. And I think somewhere in my mind, I'm trying to like find a way to put them all together and then have them be a pilot for a TV show or a short film or something. But, I mostly just write scenarios that I find, funny. But yeah, I don't know.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I guess I would say like the lesson of a two-part lesson of honesty and acceptance. Being really honest with yourself about who you are, what you believe in, what you stand for, what you're willing to speak out about and what you're not. And then being accepting of that, being gentle with yourself along those lines, but then taking that to a macro level, appreciating honesty from those around you when they give it to you and accepting their point of view as being completely valid. Duality or dualism, I don't know which word is a real one and which is a fake. Check out Google. The idea of holding two dissenting opinions or points of view on an issue in your head at the exact same time and recognizing both as being equally valid and that being okay, has been kind of an illumination for me of, there's people who I love and respect and turn to for advice that I just don't agree with their opinions on several different large issues. But realizing that their opinions were formed in a real way and they have a reason for them. And I don't just get to be right. And appreciating their point of view. It's just, yeah, I guess like acceptance and honesty is two good lessons to learn anytime. So I don't know if that was just this year or if it's a thing I've been learning for, especially this year. That's really true. Yeah.
So what's it like to be dating another artist since your girlfriend is an actress too?
She's a a special actress because
she is,
I've.
And hopefully she's going to be on the podcast.
Yeah, she should be. She should be because she's fantastic. Okay, so there's like, I have dated other actresses before and other artists and then people who aren't artists at all. And I, you know, I've heard the lots of people, I'm probably not you and Frankie because you're both actors, but like, but a lot of people are like, oh my God, just don't date an actress. They're the worst, man. Yeah. And I'm like,
it just doesn't work for everybody. It has to be the right people.
Yeah. But the thing that I've really come to realize is like, no, I just think like some people are difficult and some people aren't.
Yeah.
Or some people are really well matched together and some people aren't. And that's fine. And it has very little to do with your profession is or like, you know, because I'm an actor and there's plenty of people that I don't think care for me or the way I go about doing things. But for some people, it really works. You know, my gal and I, we get along together because we're witty and fun and funny and we're competitive. So like we are always just rushing to try and get to the punchline first, trying to build on each other's jokes. I mean, we spend a lot of our day building fantasy imagination worlds in our heads or like out in the living room where we're just creating characters and making fun of each other and trying to like get to the next, you know, it's Beatrice and Benedict from Much Ado, but without the, she hasn't asked me to kill anybody yet.
Oh my God. Laughter is the most important thing.
It really is. It's the thing I've realized that I miss in my life.
Well, you know? I realize every time Frankie goes out of town, he'll come back and be like, nobody's made me laugh for days.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's true. But as far as being two artists together, in some ways, it's the best medicine because I go to that audition and I feel bad about myself because, like, apparently that guy thinks I'm ugly and I'll never work in TV, or at least that's what like my dark little passenger in the back of my brain tells me. He's just like my beard, right? To be fair, I should trim this mother up, but I like feel that way for a second. And I think that somebody not in our profession, not knowing exactly like what those feelings are that you go through when you walk into that audition room, might just be like, oh, I'm sure he didn't mean it, or, you know, whatever. But like, she knows exactly how to like get inside my head, say all the right things and calm me down and help me like move on to the brightness of the rest of the day. In that regard, you know, dating a fellow actor, fellow artist is fantastic because she's been in and is in the trenches with me every day. And it's also, it's nice for me too, because I feel like we're not so separate. And I know, you know, when she's down in the dumps or she doesn't feel good, like it does make you feel good as a partner to feel like you're helping. And so like when I like, you know the right things to say for this particular thing, 'cause I've been through it. I mean, like, that's just the best. I feel like I'm the best boyfriend ever. And then, you know, on the other side, we're both going to be poor for the rest of our lives. So that part of being an actor is like, man, one of us really should have got our MBA, I guess. But no, I don't see too many downsides. And she just keeps me super informed of all the parts of the social conversation that like I may not be aware of, or like have somehow found a way to like shut out. She doesn't let me get away with that. You know, she's a deeply feeling artist, as I believe I am too, but like we're two different people and two different genders, frankly. Mm-hmm. And as a man, I think, you know, to stay woke as a feminist man, yeah, I said it. Yeah. Sometimes it's really helpful to have a female advocate pointing out to you, you know, not only the things that are happening in the world, but the things that like, are you sort of ignoring that? You should not ignore that. That's not the way, you know.
That's great.
Yeah. And I appreciate it because it's hard to know the things you don't know.
Are there any concrete things that you kind of grab onto on those days where you're feeling really down and you go back to?
Yes. And they're really easy, and yet they're deceptively difficult.
Okay.
So, like, I've gone back to school a couple of times, and I've assistant directed, and I've, like, spoken in some classes, sometimes about the theater company, sometimes just, you know, to, like, help as an actor, witness class or whatever. But so, like, the advice I always give about when you get out of school is to, like, structure your day, because you've been at school in this highly structured environment for 4 years, and then you get out, and you're like, woo, great. Got nothing to do. I've got no reason. And I'll tell you, man, I like that for, I think I was like born to be a college student my whole life. Cause I just
there's
like,
something wonderful about that period of your life.
I loved it, man. I loved it so much. I did it twice. Like that's how much I loved being a college student. And
there's
that
much less of a map.
Totally.
Especially for this career.
Totally. And that first year out, I was very happy to stay up till all hours of the morning and then wake up whenever I woke up and then like eat whenever I felt like. But then there's all of a sudden your day becomes this like amorphous thing that it's hard to get motivated to do anything. So the thing I always say to people is just wake up at a certain time so that you can do something you like. Like, just wake up so that you can watch SportsCenter at 10 in the morning. 10 is not early. It's not too late. You can get up, you can watch SportsCenter, you watch SportsCenter, then you're like, then you're up, you've done something you like already, then you can start doing your thing with your day. Those are the things I definitely do. I'm a big, for being this like college student who likes to sleep in and do whatever, I'm also like a big list maker. Like I like to make lists. I like to just feel like I've accomplished things. Mm-hmm. So on those times, like, for example, right now, like I said, like, my house is really clean and, like, my email inbox is empty. Those are things I set up for myself. Like, today's the day you have nothing else that you have to do, but, like, you should do those things. It'll make you feel like you did something. Yeah. And then once you're doing that, then you're like, okay, so, like, now I'm actually going to do this next thing because I'm on a roll. I'm going. I've got things going on. You know, that being said, sometimes it's really hard to wake up at 10 in the morning to watch SportsCenter. It is. If you're sad or if you're in a like,
yeah. But you like giving yourself a structure to cling to.
Yeah, yeah. That's a concrete thing I like to do. Mm-hmm. And another concrete thing I like to do is to just like get out and see somebody that you haven't seen in a while, or somebody, you know, just like, get out and see people is always my go-to, because I'm a very social person, and if I'm alone for too long, I start to feel weepy. So I just try to go somewhere, usually with somebody who I know I can like be funny with. We can make jokes together. If that's going to happen, that'll make me feel the best. Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations of things you've seen recently or friends' shows maybe?
Yeah. Well, I just saw Hadestown at New York Theater Workshop. Fantastic.
I'm so jealous.
Everybody in the company is doing some real just like beautiful work and also heartbreaking. It's gorgeous.
Is it open-ended? Are they ending anytime soon?
I think they go till the end of July. I think they go till July 30th.
So you haven't been able to get tickets, but I really want to see Damon in it.
I know. He's great.
Okay.
He's great. He's like a cherub rock star, if there ever was one.
He
He's pretty incredible.
Okay,
that's what I did. I went, I got rush tickets for a Sunday night show, and the box office opens at noon. I was the only one there.
Okay.
So it's possible. And they're like $25.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, anything else?
I just think this podcast is so cool, and I'm so happy that you're making it. I haven't heard all the episodes. I think I've missed a couple along the way, but I've heard a lot of them, and it's just, thanks for doing this. Thanks for like.
Thank you. You've been so supportive from the beginning.
My pleasure. This has been so cool because not only is it a chance for all of us to hear all these different artists' voices, but I think it's also a really cool thing that this is a part of the fabric of the story we tell. Like these are all recorded now.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's.
Well, this is our community, and I'm really proud to document the things people are doing, even if
yeah.
not a lot of people see them in the present.
That's awesome, though. You know, in years to come, you know, I wish. Like, I wish I could have heard Jim Houghton or Oscar Eustace or somebody speak when they were my age, yeah. you know, and know where their head was at, know what they were after then, maybe how that's changed now, to see what they've built and become. My pleasure. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.